Good afternoon and welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm John Diaz, editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and your moderator for today's program. We are very pleased to welcome Sassy Chambliss, United States Republican Senator representing the state of Georgia. He is here to speak about his view of the overlap between America's fiscal policy and our national security. He has questioned, how can America address domestic or international crises and adapt to emerging threats both here and abroad when we have that staggering $17 trillion debt? Chambliss was first elected to Congress in 1994. He served as chairman of the House Intelligence Subcommittee on Terrorism and Homeland Security and released a report detailing those shortfalls within the United States intelligence community's performance and technological capabilities immediately following the September 11th terrorist attacks. 8 years later, he was elected to the U.S. Senate, where he continued his work on national security issues and now serves as vice chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, along with our California Senator Dianne Feinstein. In 2011, Senators Chambliss and Mark Warner co-founded the bipartisan Senate partnership known as the Gang of Six, which focused on acting on our nation's deficit and other issues with lawmakers from both sides of the aisle. Senator Chambliss' announcement that he will not be seeking a third term in the Senate has spurred quite a race for his seat between Georgia Republicans and Democrats. The New York Times even reported that control of the Senate may hinge on the Georgia race. I suspect there may be a question or two on that issue as well. Please join me in welcoming Senator Sassy Chambliss to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you, John. Well, John, thank you very much, and thank you for coming out today and let me have an opportunity to share some thoughts with you. And when I do these things similar to this around the country, I usually find out that I learn as much from you as you'll learn from me about what's going on in California and what's going on in the world. As John said, I've had the privilege of working with a number of my colleagues from California, principally right now Dianne Feinstein, who chairs the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. I have been the vice chair for the last 4 years serving with Dianne, and I was on the committee for 8 years prior to that serving with her. And Dianne is a good friend and a great leader and someone that I've enjoyed working with, and I'll talk a little bit more about some things that we have done together. John mentioned my chairmanship on the Subcommittee on Terrorism and Homeland Security of the House Intelligence Committee. My really good friend Jane Harmon from the Los Angeles area was the ranking member on that subcommittee. And Jane and I traveled the world and dodged some bullets together in some very unusual places around the world leading up to 9/11 and following 9/11. I always enjoy working with Californians, and I'm particularly pleased to be here today. I thought I would start by just taking a minute to tell you what's happening in the Senate. Now that I've done that, we'll move on to other issues. There literally is not a lot going on in the Senate these days. We have had a number of crises that we should have been addressing, and occasionally we do find a solution, such as the Veterans Administration bill that we passed recently, and it's already been signed into law by the president, which is a whole other story I could take all afternoon talking to you about. But a good example of why the Senate, or at least how the Senate is doing nothing, how we're operating now, took place right before we left. California's right in the middle, along with all of our other southern border states, of having to deal with the crisis, particularly these young children, but as we know, for the most part, it's not young children. It's mostly adults, but still a lot of children just kind of being driven to the border by the folks who used to run the drug cartels and dumped off, knowing that America is going to accept these individuals, and then we're trying to deal with the problem of what we do with them and how we're going to ultimately deal with these young people, particularly that are dropped off at our borders. And they bring all sorts of issues from disease to mental disabilities because they've been so abused by the time they get there. And I could go on and on talking about that. But we need to deal with that issue. Congress has a responsibility to deal with issues like that. And while we had a lot of debate and on the House side, actually some activity, some substantive activity to pass a bill that deals with this issue, and the House actually appropriated or authorized some money to provide for these young folks and provide for not just food and housing for them, but trying to figure out a way that we're going to deal with them to hopefully ultimately either integrate them here or send them back to where they come from and reunite them with their families, hopefully back in southern and Central American countries. But on the Senate side, we had a similar bill that came up before us. And as we normally do on a Monday afternoon, we're called back into town to vote on a judge, and we vote on judges or executive noms that the White House sends up. And we did that the last Monday we were in town, and then we voted on cloture, which means a vote to go to the border security bill, the bill to deal with these folks who are dumped at the border. And there were a lot of Republicans like me, who joined with Democrats to vote to proceed to the bill because it is an issue that we need to address head on. And we need to debate the bill. But the bill as presented to us was not a bill that I could vote for, but I wanted the opportunity to file amendments, debate the bill. Then, if the amendments pass, fine. If they don't pass, fine. You either vote the bill up or down at the end of the day. But what the leadership in the Senate has done over the last several weeks and months is we'll have this vote on Monday to go to the bill, and then instead of giving Republicans and Democrats amendments to a bill, the leader has his own amendments, which he'll do what we call fill the tree. And he allows no amendments and no debate on amendments that Republicans or Democrats may want to offer. And so come Thursday, we'll have a vote to get off the bill, and we don't invoke cloture to get off of it. So we pack up and go home for another week, and then we'll repeat that cycle the next week. This border security issue is something that I do hope that we will have the opportunity to address when we get back in September, because it's not going away. I've been in Congress now 20 years, as John said. I've been on the Armed Services Committee in the House for the 8 years that I was there, and in the Armed Services Committee on the Senate side for all 12 years I've been in the Senate. I was on the House Intel Committee for 2 years. I've been on the Senate Intelligence Committee now for 12 years, and have been vice chairman for 4 years. And when you're vice chairman or chairman, as Diane and I are, it puts you in a little bit of a different position from an information standpoint, in that the CIA or the DIA or whatever the intelligence agency is that has a particular matter that they are involved with and picking up information on, they share information with Diane and me that doesn't go to other members of the committee if it's a sensitive issue, i.e., Diane and I knew about the plans to take down bin Laden, gosh, I don't know, I'm going to say 7 or 8 months before it actually happened. I think it happened on May 1. I became vice chairman in January, and the first meeting I had, Leon Panetta called me the day that I was named vice chairman, said, I got to come talk to you today. So that's the kind of information that we get. When I think about the way the world was in 1995 when I went to Washington from a small South Georgia town, and I think about the difference in the way that world looks today, boy, is it ever different from a national security standpoint. Today we have ongoing conflicts in Afghanistan and obviously now again in Iraq. We've gone through a situation in Libya. We're in the middle of a conflict in Syria. We've seen uprisings in Egypt, Tunisia, and any number of other countries in North Africa and in the Middle East. And then obviously the latest situation we've had is the ongoing and ever-continuing conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Lots of complications around the world. And let's face it, the United States, even though there are a lot of folks who criticize us, sometimes justifiably, but whether it's a military conflict, a natural disaster, or an economic disaster, the first country that's looked to is the United States of America. And the reason they look to us is they know we're going to respond, and they know we're going to respond in a positive way. So obviously, we are now in the middle of each of these conflicts in a little bit different way in each one of them. And situation in Iraq continues to deteriorate. And I was in a meeting at the White House the Thursday before we left on Friday, a week and a half ago now. And there were about 10 of us from the House and the Senate that were called down there, and it's folks who deal with national security matters. And we had a sit-down with the President just to kind of review all of these issues before we got out for our August break. And all of us have an opportunity to express ourselves to the President. And when it came my turn to do so, I said, Mr. President, here's my thought about where we are in the situations that right now, in my mind, are the two most serious that are facing you from a decision standpoint. We're still trying to feel our way through Syria. I don't have the answer for what ought to be done in Syria, but we do know that there have been about 170,000 people inside of Syria killed over the last several months and years. Bashar Assad is a guy that we ought not to leave in power. And how we deal with that, obviously, is an issue that the President continues to wrestle with every day. The other issue that is related to Syria is what's going on in Iraq today. Now, there's no need to rehash why we went into Iraq. The situation is what it is. There's no reason to rehash, in my mind, whether we should have left troops there or not. We didn't. And we're having to deal with whatever the situation is on the ground today. And the President has some very tough decisions to make. But I wanted him to know, because of the information that I get every day as a member of the Armed Services Committee and as well as a member of the Intelligence Committee, I get information relative to how bad it is on the ground. And you don't have to be in those closed sessions getting briefed by the CIA to go to YouTube and see where 8 Christian men were taken out in front of a mosque about 3 weeks ago and beheaded because they wouldn't renounce their loyalty to Christianity by these folks called ISIS or ISIL. ISIL actually is the correct name, but whatever it is. These are not good people. These are kind of people that if they have the opportunity, they will come to American soil just like those individuals pre-9/11 decided they wanted to come to American soil and inflict death and destruction on America and Americans. We do have a vested interest in Iraq because of the fact that we have a number of diplomatic personnel there. But we're law-abiding folks who don't want to see the terrorist community anywhere in the world get legs and grow in a way that we're seeing that happen inside of Iraq now. John and I were talking earlier. There's been some criticism of the intelligence community for not giving us a warning that ISIL was going to move in the way that they did. Well, we knew what was going on. We had been having briefings the end of last year and into this year. There's a guy inside of Iraq now who heads up ISIL who had been in Syria. He's a guy that we've known for many years to be involved with an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. He's a very dangerous person, and we knew that he was organizing a group of folks. What we didn't know was that when that organized group of militants attacked the Iraqi forces inside of Iraq in the Mosul area, as you'll remember, to begin with, we didn't know that the Iraqi military were going to simply lay down their arms and run. And that's basically what they did. The other thing that we as Americans have a hard time understanding about that part of the world is the relationship, I don't know whether hatred is the right word or not, I hate to use that word, but the dislike between sects, particularly the Sunnis and the Shias. And it was Sunni against Sunni when it was ISIL going after the city of Mosul. It was Sunni against Sunni with ISIL going after the town of Tikrit. But then it became Sunni versus Shia when they got close to Baghdad. And all of a sudden we saw the Iraqi military stiffen somewhat and do a better job of defending themselves. But I told the president that day that he's got to do something. We can't sit idly by and just watch that country disintegrate, knowing that Syria is leaning now towards a breeding ground for terrorists. There is no border between Syria and Iraq. These armed individuals are going back and forth into each of those conflicts, which means that Iraq would become a breeding ground for terrorists. Those terrorists would make plans, again, long range to kill and harm Americans. So I said, Mr. President, you've told us that you've got potential airstrikes on the table for discussion. As long as you've got a goal set and you do it right, this is one member of the Senate that's going to support you. So I have been supportive of the president's action to try to attack these individuals to slow them down, hopefully take away some of their weaponry and give the Iraqi forces the opportunity to defend themselves and defend freedom for their country. Just as Tyler and I were coming in today, we got word that not only has a new prime minister been appointed, but that prime minister now is named a new president, and it's not Mr. Maliki, which is a good move. He needs to move on. And an individual who is a Shia, who actually worked for Maliki, and he's the deputy speaker of the current Iraqi parliament, he is the individual who's been named the president. I'm going to take that as a positive step, and hopefully we're going to see a government put together that can defend Iraq and defend democracy, which, let's don't kid ourselves, democracy in Iraq is not what we think of as a democracy or a republic in the United States, but it's what's best for the Iraqi people that we should want there. And yet we've got all of these scenarios swirling around the world. And here we are in America dealing with another crisis of our own. My friend Admiral Mike Mullen, who is a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has continuously said that the number one national security interest facing the United States of America is not Al-Qaeda, it's our debt. We are today spending about $227 billion a year in interest payments on our debt that now exceeds $17 trillion. Folks, if we don't get our arms around this issue of how much money we owe, you let interest rates just bump up a little bit, and can you imagine the direction in which those payments are going to go? On the current scale and the current direction in which our country is going from an economic standpoint, in the year 2020, and that's not very far away, our interest payments are going to equal the amount of money we spend on defense. And if we don't change things between now and 2030, all of the entitlements that we pay for in this country are going to exceed the amount of tax revenues that we take in. So that everything that we do from a discretionary standpoint, i.e. defense, housing, all of our social programs, all of that discretionary spending, for the most part veterans, all of that money is going to have to be borrowed. And who's going to pay it back It's not our generation. It's these young folks, that some of whom I see out here today, that are going to have the responsibility of paying that back, and that's not right. We need to have a long-term plan to pay that mortgage off. We need to have a plan in place that tells the next generation of Americans, look, we inherited a great country, and we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that you inherit that same great America. And I will tell you that if we don't stare this problem down and we don't fix this problem for the next generation, they are going to be the first generation of Americans to inherit a country that is not as great as the country that we inherited. Senator Warner and I worked very hard with four other, two Republicans and two Democrats, to try to address this problem. And unfortunately, we got to a point to where folks are going to have to make hard and tough votes. And we were prepared to do that, but we simply couldn't get that idea and that concept to the floor and could not get encouragement from enough other folks, particularly in leadership, that they were willing to bring these hard and tough votes up to the floor of the Senate so we can begin to solve this problem. It's not rocket science that as to what it's going to take to solve this problem. We're spending too much money in Washington. You got to cut that spending. We've got to reform entitlement programs. Otherwise, they're going broke, and they're not going to be there for the next generation. And then thirdly, we need to reform a very broken and outdated tax code. If we do it in the right way, we will generate additional revenues. And the combination of all three of those will solve our problem long term. And I hope when I leave at the end of this year, that we will have a foundation there that can be built upon by the next group of members of the House and the Senate to address this problem and take it head on. Lastly, I'm here for another issue entirely over the next couple of days. I'm speaking at a cybersecurity conference down in Palo Alto tomorrow. Cybersecurity, in my opinion, or the issue of cyber, is the next battlefield that America is going to be fighting on. The Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians are masters at attacking us from a cyber standpoint. And we've got to make sure that we have the capability to respond to those cyber attacks. And I'm going to be talking with some very smart folks down in the Silicon Valley over the next couple of days about how we are approaching it from a policymaker standpoint. And we're going to need to work hand in hand with those folks and other folks around the world in the private sector to solve this problem and to put in place a program that allows the protection of the private sector as well as the public sector from these continual cyber attacks that we're seeing every single day. Well, Dianne Feinstein told me when I came to talk to y'all, she said, don't talk very long, but take lots of questions. So I'm going to stop. And I look forward to your questions. Thank you very much.
We do have questions.
Thank you very much, Senator. This is the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Diaz, the editorial page editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm pleased to be here with Senator Saxby Chambliss, a Republican from Georgia. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio. You can catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter. And you can see a video on our YouTube channel, or in this case, we're pleased to join C-SPAN. Let's get to some of these questions. Senator, there were a number of questions. You touched on several really rich topics. A number of the questions came in on your observations about Iraq, and particularly the fact that, as you indicated, the intelligence was basically there, that you could see what was developing. A number of questions as to why it took President Obama so long to respond, and whether you think it could have made a difference if he had intervened earlier.
Well, first of all, the information was there. I remember very well a briefing we had from Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, who until last Friday was head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. That briefing from General Flynn took place in either December or January And I remember him talking about this core leadership of this group known as back then they were ISIS, and now they've spread into what we call the Levant, which is Syria. They want to not just move in Iraq, but in surrounding countries like Jordan and others. But I remember him talking about these folks are becoming more and more radical. They're becoming more and more militant. And we've got our eyes on them. And we're concerned about what action they're going to take. But what Mike and John Brennan, the director of the CIA, couldn't predict is what I alluded to. And that is the reaction of the Iraqi army. And the president, you know, got the same information that we got. He wasn't getting anything. He wasn't hearing anything different from what we heard. But at a point in time, when we saw Mosul fall, and we saw this group called ISIL, who wants to create a caliphate or an Islamic state from Syria to Iraq to Jordan and as far as they'll go, that really is a much more militant Islamic state than we see anywhere now. It may have been the time to act. Yeah, I mean, you never know. I'm not saying the president should have done something the day that the attack on Mosul took place. But he's got a lot of smart people around him from a national security standpoint. He obviously was not being advised by them to go on the offense against this group. It's pretty easy to sit back now and say, well, if we had, we would have slowed them down. I do wish he had, as a matter of course, weeks ago instead of now versus months ago when all of this started. But, you know, as I say, blame game doesn't get us anywhere. We are where we are, and going forward, the president said this is not going to be easy. He's right. He said it's not going to be solved in the short term. He's right. He said we're not going to put boots on the ground. I hope he's right there, because nobody wants to see American boots on the ground in Iraq, I assure you.
I think the word that the phrase that scares a lot of Americans is mission creep. The president indicated over the weekend that we are looking at a matter of months here. How do we avoid mission creep, and what role do you think the Senate and in particular is going to play in trying to contain this?
Well, the definition of mission creep is in the mind of the beholder. Some folks say we're there now just by going in and carrying out airstrikes. I don't believe that. I think the president has been deliberate. Some would argue maybe too deliberate. But he has been deliberate in justifying in his mind the decision that he made. I guess last Friday was when the decision was ultimately made to carry out the airstrikes. But he also had directed that these airstrikes be put on the table, that the planning begin. You don't just decide you're going to do that, and a couple hours later, F-18s take off from an aircraft carrier. The planning was in place so that when he did make the decision, then the F-18s could carry out the strikes. So, as to where we go from here, what extent we're going to go to relative to additional offensive action there, you know, it's all going to be dictated by what happens on the ground. We know, for example, that the ISIL forces are now gathering women and children around them. It's a favorite tactic to use women and children as shields. We're committed to not having collateral damage. That just means innocent people being injured or killed in strikes that we carry out. That's going to become harder and harder to do. So if these strikes are going to be successful, they're probably going to have to be done in a little bit different way, and somebody at some point in time, hopefully, it's going to be 100% the Iraqi boots on the ground, that carries the fight to the enemy there.
How do you make the case to Americans that this is in our national interest to stop ISIL?
Well, it's in our national interest from a couple of very obvious perspectives. Number one, we've got people on the ground there. We have a diplomatic corps still in Iraq. We spent, whatever figure I give, it'll be the wrong figure. But my recollection is about $25 million on an embassy in Baghdad. It's inside the Green Zone. And we have a staff there. We have American interests in Iraq. We have an economic interest there. We have American businesses in Iraq that certainly we have a diplomatic responsibility to. In addition to that, we know for a fact that terrorist groups would love to have all or some part of Iraq to carry out training missions for the long term to plan and ultimately carry out missions against Americans or American interest in any part of the world that they can find a soft spot. But ultimately, they would love to plan those attacks to come to America. We can't let that happen. We allowed that to happen, unfortunately, in Afghanistan leading up to 9/11. We learned a lesson from that, and now we're trying to make sure that we do carry out the methods that are necessary to keep those folks from being able to train bad guys from coming to America.
You mentioned the change in leadership in Iraq, although Maliki is suggesting that he was not going to go quietly. Do you think a unified Iraq is really a probability or something that we should be aspiring for?
Well, as I said earlier, a unified government or a democratic form of government in Iraq is not what Americans would look at and say, wow, that's kind of a mirror of America. It's a different culture, it's a different mindset, and it's pure and simple a different people with a long history of conflict, a long history of economic troubles, a long history of living in a neighborhood where those types of conflicts and economic difficulties have been a way of life. So what we would love to see, obviously, is a new leadership come in with a regime that puts economic policies in place that give young people hope inside of Iraq, that gives young people the opportunity to earn a quality of living that will give them a quality of life to raise their children in a better atmosphere than where they are today or where they've been for the last several years, and then be able to unify Sunnis and Shias and Kurds together in a way that will allow them to defend themselves from a military standpoint. That is a very, very difficult proposition. But it has the potential to be done, and we've got to be there in a support role all the way to the end to try to make sure that this new leadership that's coming in as we sit here today, that they're able to unite the parliament first and create a new government, which they've been charged to do, that will allow that movement towards peace and at the same time allow the military to operate in a defensive and an offensive way to ensure that peace.
Do you worry that a few years after we withdraw from Afghanistan, we're going to be going through a similar situation there?
Absolutely. It's one of those things that keeps me awake at night because I know what's going on inside of Afghanistan from the standpoint of what the Taliban is doing. They know we're leaving. There's still a lot of activity inside of Afghanistan from a offensive standpoint. We all know, unfortunately, and our hearts and prayers go out to the Green family, but we had a general that was killed last Friday, highest-ranking Army official that has been killed since Vietnam. So it's still a very dangerous place today. But that's an indication to us that when we leave, it's going to get more dangerous.
let's turn to some of your work on the Intelligence Committee. There's been a lot written and discussed in the past few days about this report that's coming out on enhanced interrogation techniques. You've been very critical of the report, suggesting it was politicized.
And I'm still of that mind. You know, we're 13 years away now from 9/11. After 9/11 happened, after we saw two planes hit the Twin Towers, a plane hit the Pentagon, a plane go down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, in excess of 3,000 Americans were killed by an outfit called Al-Qaeda that nobody in America basically had heard of to any great degree. I remember Jane Harmon and I got our staff, who were very familiar with Al-Qaeda, to make a presentation to all members of Congress. We invited all 435 members of the House to a meeting where we had our staff explain who Al-Qaeda is and what we were now facing as Americans from a military standpoint. If we captured some of those individuals, people wanted to make sure that we got the right kind of information from them that wouldn't allow September 11 to happen again. Further we've gotten away from that, the more difficult the issue relative to detention and interrogation has become. CIA was charged with a responsibility that was new to them. They're not in the detention and interrogation business. They're in the gathering of intelligence business. But they were charged with putting together a program which, in effect, they were told, if we capture a high-value target, then we're going to turn these individuals over to you, and you're to interrogate them, and you're to get what information you can from them, and then we're going to do something with them. That was even before Guantanamo was ever created. And that's what they did. It was not the best program in the world from a rendition, detention, interrogation standpoint, but the CIA and the White House told the Justice Department, look, here's what we're going to do. Give us legal opinions as to what we can do with these individuals. They got those opinions, and they operated within the legal parameters that they were told by the Department of Justice. I happen to think that we got an awful lot of information out of these individuals. And in our report, we're going to document some of the information that we obtained from those individuals. There will be a forever argument about whether or not the enhanced interrogation techniques that were used went above and beyond. And that's an argument that, I'm not going to defend the CIA. They're very capable of defending themselves. But the fact is that we got a lot of information that ultimately, in all probability, saved American lives because we thwarted and disrupted potential plots down the road.
As you noted, it seems like there's two elements here when we talk about enhanced interrogation or torture, if you will. One is it legal and ethical? And the second, is it effective? On the latter point, in terms of effectiveness, you suggested there is evidence that it has been effective in getting valuable information. How much of that is going to be available to the American people where it can really be convincing? Because there is a lot of debate, as we're seeing with the Senate report.
Well, the Senate report itself that was done 100% by the Democratic staff is 6,600 pages. It cost about in excess of $40 million, and it's taken place over a period of 5 years. In compiling that 6,600 pages, there was not one single interview conducted of an individual. It was all done by reading documents that the CIA and others had completed after or during interrogation and whatnot. The CIA is going to have a response to that and say that if you had asked us about this, here's what we would have told you. we have minority views that take the position, as I said, that substantive information was gleaned from those individuals. We will give certain specific instances that I think will not be redacted totally. There will be some redactions in there. We can't reveal sources and methods. The 6,600-page report will not be released at this time, but there's a 500-page summary, a response from the CIA, and minority views that will all be released. And my understanding is that about 85% of all of those documents is going to be released. About 15% will be marked out with a black line. So that's a pretty good amount of information that's going to come out. Diane wants more than that, and they're in discussion with the White House on that now.
I saw in your interview with Face the Nation that it was your opinion that waterboarding is not torture and that it is consistent with the Geneva Conventions.
No, that was not my opinion. I never gave my opinion on waterboarding. What I said then was that the White House and the CIA consulted the Department of Justice and said, here are the techniques that we're going to use. And they were told that under UN convention treaties that apparently those types of techniques are within the treaties. But that's not my opinion. That was DOJ's opinion.
What do you make of the argument that some make that the use of these enhanced interrogation techniques is actually put Americans at greater risk when they're captured?
Well, you know, there was a reporter from the Wall Street Journal who was captured by Al-Qaeda and they cut his head off.
Daniel Pearl.
We can cite any number of instances where there's been terrible treatment given to Americans, whether they were military or not, that had been captured. Al-Qaeda doesn't know what the Geneva Convention is. ISIL does not know what the Geneva Convention is. You know, we train Americans, particularly our special forces individuals, in what we call SERI techniques that include very harsh treatment during their training, in preparation for a point in time but when they may get captured. I would hope that never happens, but folks, we have to be honest. We can't kid ourselves. These are the meanest, nastiest people in the world that we're dealing with. They flew an airplane into the World Trade Center knowing they were going to die, but yet they look forward to it because that's their mindset. And those are the individuals we're dealing with. These are not bank robbers out there. These are killers. And we need to remember that if they capture Americans, whether they're military or not, they're not going to be dealt with in a very pleasant way.
Here is an audience member question. Speaking of the CIA, are you concerned that the CIA has monitored your investigators' computers?
Yes. Yes, I am very concerned about that. And not only am I concerned about it, we know they did it. And it was not right. It's not just a violation of the Constitution, because it is a violation of separation of powers. But this is work that our staff, wasn't my staff, well, I say that, the whole staff that works for the committee is Diane and mine, both staff. But that was our staff working on those computers. CIA had no right to encroach on the work that they were doing. I don't care whether our staff did something wrong or not. The CIA had no business going into our side of the computers. And I expect Director Brennan to deal harshly with those individuals who, whether they did or not, I'm going to leave that up to the accountability board. But if they worked for me, I would have fired them.
What about Mr. Brennan? Should he be held accountable as well?
Well, the OIG made an investigation of our side of the computers. And the Inspector General made a specific finding that John Brennan did not know this had taken place. When he found out it had taken place, he ordered it stopped immediately, and he immediately called Chairman Feinstein and me and came to the Hill and briefed us within a matter of a couple of days. He then came back and briefed us again when he found out what had happened. And so he kept us fully informed, and so I have no reason to disagree with the finding of the Inspector General. And if John knew it, it'd be different. But because he didn't know it, I expect him to deal with his employees directly. But John Brennan, as far as I can tell, did not know this was going on.
Let's turn to the issue of the National Security Agency and its surveillance, particularly domestic surveillance. Senator Patrick Leahy just recently introduced a Senate version of a bill that would rein in the NSA to some extent. I saw where you were quoted saying it's going to be very difficult to get a bill out of Capitol Hill, given that the House has passed a different version. What is your view in terms of where the line should be drawn on NSA surveillance?
Well, if I were concerned that anybody at NSA was listening in on a telephone conversation of anybody sitting in this room today, I would be totally outraged. But again, we get briefed on these programs on a regular basis. I've been to NSA any number of times. I've watched what they do. That's part of our oversight. That's part of my responsibility as a representative of you, and Diane's responsibility as a representative of you, to know what these programs are and to know what they do and to know how far NSA is going with programs of this nature. And we do that. There is no program in the intelligence community that is more highly scrutinized than what we call the metadata collection program that NSA has been operating. After 9/11, Congress approved what we call the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that gives our NSA, gives CIA, and our other folks in the intelligence community certain power and authority to try to deal with the bad guys around the world and to gather use every tool possible to gather information from them. Section 215 and Section 702 are the two provisions in that FISA bill that gives the NSA the authority to collect telephone numbers from individuals around the country and around the world and to store those. But this is the key. They store them. Telephone companies store them today. They have ever since we've had telephone companies. This is the NSA simply storing those numbers and not being able to access those numbers without a court order. And you would like to think that would give people some comfort that NSA is only going to look at telephone records of folks who are carrying out activities that are not in accord with U.S. law and that are in opposition to U.S. interests. Unfortunately, when you have a revelation like came out of Mr. Snowden, all of that changes. Unfortunately, some of the things that Mr. Snowden said could happen can't happen. And I can't talk to you about them because they can't happen. Keith Alexander, the just retired director of the NSA, has talked in more detail about some of those things. But there is reason to look at a program like this. There is reason to try to make it more transparent. I think Americans ought to know what we're doing. But I can just assure you that nobody's telephone record is ever authorized to be looked into unless there is a case made to a judge, a federal judge, that this individual is engaged in terrorist activity or he is engaged with some individuals who are engaged in terrorist activity. I have been a supporter of the NSA on the 215 program. I do think we ought to make it transparent. People ought to know how many times it's accessed, and you would be shocked to know that we've accumulated millions and millions of telephone numbers, but only a very minuscule number of those telephone numbers have ever been looked into from a content standpoint. You get your telephone bill every month. It's got the day you made a long-distance call, the number you called, the length of time you talked, and what it cost you to make that call. That's what we call metadata. And that's the information that telephone companies keep and that NSA is stored. Nobody can look at that information until a judge has issued an order saying, based upon the information that's been presented to me as a judge, I think it's in the national security of the United States for that number to be modified. We've done that on the mob, for example, for decades. You get a court order, and you can carry out a wiretap on it. It's the exact same scenario. It's just a different program that we're operating under.
Let's turn to the debt and the deficit, which your comments there drew a number of audience questions, including this one. President Obama lost me when he appointed the Simpson-Bowles Commission to come up with ideas to reduce the debt and then ignored its recommendations. Do you think there's any hope for something getting done in Washington?
Yeah, Mark Warner and I got together in the summer of 2010, and we began talking about this issue regarding the debt and the deficit. And during that period of time, Republicans were out campaigning, Democrats were out campaigning. This is in the Senate. And nobody was talking about the debt and the deficit. And yet, we knew that this is long-range the biggest issue that we're all facing, and that's kind of what started us. We also knew that the president had appointed this commission that became known as the Simpson-Bowles Commission, and that we knew that in December of 2010, they were going to issue a report. And we didn't know what it was going to say. But what was really ironic about that is that as Mark and I talked to any number of individuals around the country, experts from the business world, the world of economics, professors, as well as government individuals in the government who understand budgeting and the direction we're going, we came up with some similar conclusions, and they're the conclusions that I said earlier are what has got to happen if we're going to really solve this problem, and that is you got to cut spending, you got to reform entitlements, and you've got to figure out a way to get revenues up, and we do that through reforming the tax code. Simpson-Bowles came up with a plan that is almost that simple. And the person that asked that question is exactly right. I mean, the president had every opportunity to take some action then, but what he did was just pat Erskine Bowles and Al Simpson on the back, said, guys, you did a great job. Now we're going to put this report on the shelf, and we're going to let it gather dust. None of us agreed with everything in that report. But I wish the president had just said, I don't agree with everything in here, but by golly, Congress, this is a foundation for y'all to begin to work on. And if we had done that, then I think there's a reasonable chance that with the president really pushing it and providing leadership that we could have gotten something done. I still think that foundation is there. That's exactly the premises that the Gang of Six concluded on. And they're now only going to be three members of the Gang of Six left in the Senate, but hopefully, and I know how committed those three guys are, that they're going to carry the work on.
We had some questions, including this one, on the lack of action in Congress generally, and that is, if gridlock continues in the next few years, do you envision either, one, the Tea Party breaking from the Republican and becoming an independent party of its own, or two, moderates from Democratic and Republican parties getting together to form a new independent party, especially since more and more Americans are becoming either independent or declined to state?
Well, people have got a right to be frustrated with Washington. I mean, I'm frustrated with Washington. When I got elected in 1995, that's the first political office I'd ever run for since I left law school. I was fortunate enough to get elected, but I ran on a platform of term limits. I thought 6 terms in the House and 2 terms in the Senate was plenty. So I never envisioned that 20 years later I'd still be in Washington. We haven't done a lot of things. We haven't addressed a lot of issues that needed to be addressed over the last 20 years. But even when we did, we would make a decision that something ought to be done, and then it would take 2, 3, or 4 years to actually get it done. That's a frustration to me. And it's one of the reasons that led me to the decision not to run again. I particularly became frustrated over this fiscal issue. Mark and Dick Durbin and Kent Conrad and Mike Crapo and Tom Coburn and I spent hours and hours and hours together, and our staff spent more time than that together looking at this issue of the fiscal problems. And I say on the stump, and I mean it literally, I spent more time with Mark Warner than I spent with my wife for about a 2-year period. But we're concerned about this, and we know what the answer is. And when we presented the answer to a group of senators one morning in July of 2011, there was not just general acceptance that this is the direction in which we go, but there was general agreement that this is the direction in which we ought to go. And then we were frustrated by some outside interests who don't want to see entitlements reformed. We were frustrated by outside groups coming in and saying, well, when you talk about raising revenues, you're talking about raising taxes, and we're never going to do that. That's not right. We don't talk about, you don't have to raise taxes, and you're not going to eliminate Medicare, Social Security, those valuable programs that we all depend on. We're just going to make sure they're here for the next generation. And if we don't do that, they're just simply not going to be here. So all of us as members of the Gang of Six, and then Mike Bennett and Mike Johans joined us later to make it 8 of us, all of us shared that frustration with Congress and the inaction of Congress that members have, that people have out there now. I don't think the Tea Party is going to do anything but continue to support conservative candidates. Listen, I get sideways with them every now and then, but I believe basically in what they believe in. They're good, hardcore American values. We've had ups and downs in the political world in this country for in excess of 200 years, and if we had C-SPAN or cable TV back when Jefferson and Adams ran against each other, you wouldn't believe the nasty ads they would have run against each other.
Why do you think when you talk about these fiscal issues, like the prospect of this interest that we're paying on the debt of $200 billion plus a year and what even a modest rise in interest rates can mean, why is that not resonating with the public in a way that would overwhelm these interest groups that are trying to, from the right and left, who are trying to prevent reforms?
Well, I think the problem right now is that we're seeing the economy improve a little bit, and I say a little bit, it's a very dadgum little bit, but there is hope out there, and I think people sense that. And we've got so many other things going on. I mean, golly, it's hard to believe that it's been a couple of years now since we lost an ambassador in Benghazi. That was front page news for so long. Then you had situation in the Ukraine. That was front page for several days. We got situation in Syria that has been front page. You got situation in Iraq that is now front page. This world is just so complex right now that it seems like one crisis after another develops, and then the previous crisis goes to the back burner. But this is one crisis that's not going away. And people are going to feel it more and more when they write their check on April 15. And I think people are going to become more and more upset about the inaction on the part of Congress to address what Mike Mullen has continually said is the number one issue, and he's right from a national security standpoint that it's our debt. So we're going to continue to talk about it and hopefully keep it at the profile that it needs to be.
Maybe it's amazing that we get this next question considering the crises that you've laid out here both domestically and abroad and the frustration at getting something done. But what advice would you give for students who are interested in running for elective office someday?
Well, I cite my own example as a pretty good scenario. Number one, I graduated from law school, and I didn't have the luxury that my son had when he graduated from college. He said, "Dad, I'd like to take a trip to Europe." I had to go to work. And I moved with my wife to a small town in South Georgia, and we began our life in our community. I got involved in the community, and you naturally get involved in politics. You got good friends that run for public office, whether it's city council, school board, Congress, or whatever. You need to support those individuals, but you just need to be an average, ordinary American from the standpoint of raising your family, making a commitment to your church or your civic clubs or whatever your interests are. And when it comes time for you to get involved in politics, you'll know it. You'll particularly know when it's time for you to get involved from a candidate standpoint. I had a group of individuals who came to me after redistricting process took place in 1992 and asked me to think about running for Congress. Well, as I say, I'd never run for public office before, and I came home and told my wife that I was thinking about running for Congress. She thought I was nuts. And I remember after I made the decision, I was at a fundraiser one time, and my daughter was there, and she was in college then, I guess, and I happened to overhear her talking to one of her friends, and her friend said, "What in the world did your daddy decide to do this? Why did he decide to do it?" And my daughter said, "Well, the only thing I can figure is he's going through a midlife crisis, and this is his response to it." But I felt a strong commitment to do something for my country. I was dissatisfied and frustrated, just like folks are today. And that's why I got involved from the standpoint of running for public office. And I would just encourage young people to go out into the world and work hard, do everything you can to support your family, support your community, support your churches, and get involved in politics. Get involved in whether it's local or national politics. And if it's meant for you to run for office, you'll know it.
Well, unfortunately, with as many questions as we have, we only have time for one more, so I'll go ahead and make it a softball for you, Senator. Who's going to be the Republican nominee for president in 2016?
Well, it's not going to be me. you know, who knows? It's going to be wide open. I've got lots of good friends who certainly got it under consideration right now. We've got lots of good Republican governors around the country, lots of good former Republican governors around the country who would make excellent candidates. I've got one that lives south of me in Florida that his family is a good friend, and whether the country would go for another Bush, I don't know, but he's an example of the quality of candidates that we've got. John Kasich in Ohio, Scott Walker in Wisconsin, Chris Christie in New Jersey. I serve with Rand Paul and a number of other folks like John Thune who are certainly giving consideration to it. These are all really, really great men, all men who are committed to what's best for America. And I think at the end of the day, it'll be a slugfest, but the right person will come out, and I look forward to campaigning for him in 16.
Very good. Thank you very much, Senators Saxby Chambliss.
Thank you.
Retiring U.S. Senator from Georgia. Also want to thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm John Diaz, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.